The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Part 3, The Yoga of Divine Love, Chapter 2, The Motives of Devotion, page 552. All religion begins with the conception of some power or existence greater and higher than our limited and mortal selves. A thought, an act of worship done to that power, and an obedience offered to its will, its laws, or its demands. But religion, in its beginnings, sets an immeasurable gulf between the power thus conceived, worshipped and obeyed, and the worshipper. Yoga, in its culmination, abolishes the gulf, for yoga is union. We arrive at union with it through knowledge. For as our first obscure conceptions of it clarify, enlarge, deepen, we come to recognize it as our own highest self, the origin and sustainer of our being, and that towards which it tends. We arrive at union with it through works, for from simply obeying, we come to identify our will with its will, since only in proportion as it is identified with this power that is its source and ideal, can our will become perfect and divine. We arrive at union with it also by worship, for the thought and act of a distant worship develops into the necessity of close adoration, and this into the intimacy of love, and the consummation of love is union with the beloved. It is from this development of worship that the yoga of devotion starts, and it is by this union with the beloved that it finds its highest point and consummation. All our instincts and the movements of our being begin by supporting themselves on the ordinary motives of our lower human nature, mixed and egoistic motives at first, but afterwards they purify and elevate themselves. They become an intense and special need of our higher nature, quite apart from the results our actions bring with them. Finally, they exalt themselves into a sort of categorical imperative of our being. And it is through our obedience to this that we arrive at that supreme something self-existent in us, which was all the time drawing us towards it. First, by the lures of our egoistic nature, then by something much higher, larger, more universal, until we are able to feel its own direct attraction, which is the strongest and most imperative of all. In the transformation of ordinary religious worship into the yoga of pure bhakti, we see this development from the motived and interested worship of popular religion into a principle of motiveless and self-existent love. This last is, in fact, the touchstone of the real bhakti, and shows whether we are really in the central way or are only upon one of the bypaths leading to it. We have to throw away the props of our weakness, the motives of the ego, the lures of our lower nature before we can deserve the divine union. Faced with the sense of a power, or perhaps a number of powers greater and higher than himself, by whom his life in nature is overshadowed, influenced, governed, man naturally applies to it, or to them, the first primitive feelings of the natural being among the difficulties, desires, and dangers of that life, fear and interest. The enormous part played by these motives in the evolution of the religious instinct is undeniable. And in fact, man being what he is, it could hardly have been less. And even when religion has advanced fairly far on its road, we see these motives still surviving, active, playing a sufficiently large part, justified and appealed to by religion herself in support of her claims on man. The fear of God, it is said, or it may be added for the sake of historical truth, the fear of the gods, is the beginning of religion. A half-truth upon which scientific research, trying to trace the evolution of religion, ordinarily in a critical and often a hostile rather than in a sympathetic spirit, has laid undue emphasis. But not the fear of God only, for man does not act, even most primitively, from fear alone, but from twin motives, fear and desire, fear of things unpleasant and maleficent, and desire of things pleasant and beneficent, therefore from fear and interest. Life to him is primarily and engrossingly, until he learns to live more in his soul, and only secondarily in the action and reaction of outward things, a series of actions and results, things to be desired, pursued, and gained by action, and things to be dreaded and shunned, yet which may come upon him as a result of action. And it is not only by his own action, but by that also of others and of nature around him, that these things come to him. As soon, then, as he comes to sense a power behind all this, which can influence or determine action and result, he conceives of it as a dispenser of boons and sufferings, able and under certain conditions willing to help him or hurt, save and destroy. In the most primitive parts of his being, he conceives of it as a thing of natural egoistic impulses like himself, beneficent when pleased, maleficent when offended. Worship is then a means of propitiation by gifts, and a supplication by prayer. He gets God on his side by praying to him and flattering him. With a more advanced mentality, he conceives of the action of life as reposing on a certain principle of divine justice, which he reads always according to his own ideas and character, as a sort of enlarged copy of his human justice. He conceives the idea of moral good and evil and looks upon suffering and calamity and all things unpleasant as a punishment for his sins, and upon happiness and good fortune and all things pleasant as a reward of his virtue. God appears to him as a king, judge, legislator, executor of justice. But still regarding him as a sort of magnified man, he imagines that as his own justice can be deflected by prayers and propitiation, so the divine justice can also be deflected by the same means. Justice is to him reward and punishment, and the justice of punishment can be modified by mercy to the suppliant, While rewards can be supplemented by special favors and kindness, such as power when pleased can always bestow on its adherents and worshippers. Moreover, God, like ourselves, is capable of wrath and revenge. And wrath and revenge can be turned by gifts and supplication and atonement. He is capable, too, of partiality. And his partiality can be attracted by gifts, by prayer, and by praise. Therefore, instead of relying solely on the observation of the moral law, worship as prayer and propitiation is still continued. Along with these motives, there arises another development of personal feeling. First, of the awe which one naturally feels for something vast, powerful, and incalculable beyond our nature, by a certain inscrutability in the springs and extent of its action, and of the veneration and adoration which one feels for that which is higher in its nature, or its perfection than ourselves. For even while preserving largely the idea of a God endowed with the qualities of human nature, there still grows up along with it, mixed up with it, or superadded, the conception of an omniscience, an omnipotence, and a mysterious perfection quite other than our nature. A confused mixture of all these motives, variously developed, often modified, subtilized, or glossed over, is what constitutes 9/10 of popular religion. The other 10th is a suffusion of the rest by the percolation into it of nobler, more beautiful, and profounder ideas of the divine, which minds of a greater spirituality have been able to bring into the more primitive religious concepts of mankind. The result is usually crude enough and a ready target for the shafts of skepticism and unbelief. Powers of the human mind, which have their utility even for faith in religion, since they compel a religion to purify gradually what is crude or false in its conceptions. But what we have to see is how far in purifying and elevating the religious instinct of worship any of these earlier motives need to survive and enter into the yoga of devotion, which itself starts from worship. That depends on how far they correspond to any truth of the divine being and its relations with the human soul. For we seek by bhakti union with the divine and true relation with it, with its truth, and not with any mirage of our lower nature and of its egoistic impulses and ignorant conceptions. The ground on which skeptical unbelief assails religion, namely, that there is, in fact, no conscient power or being in the universe greater and higher than ourselves, or in any way influencing or controlling our existence, is one which yoga cannot accept, as that would contradict all spiritual experience and make yoga itself impossible. Yoga is not a matter of theory or dogma, like philosophy or popular religion, but a matter of experience. Its experience is that of a conscient, universal, and supra-cosmic being with whom it brings us into union. And this conscious experience of union with the invisible, always renewable and verifiable, is as valid as our conscious experience of a physical world and of visible bodies with whose invisible minds we daily communicate. Yoga proceeds by conscious union. The conscious being is its instrument, and a conscious union with the inconscient cannot be. It is true that it goes beyond the human consciousness and in samadhi becomes superconscient. But this is not an annihilation of our conscious being. It is only its self-exceeding, the going beyond its present level and normal limits. To be continued.